From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're coming up on the end of President Trump's first 100 days in office. So this week, we're asking lawmakers to weigh in on how the president's doing. Last night, he backed away from his insistence that funding for a border wall be part of a temporary spending bill that must pass by Saturday to keep the government running. Tomorrow, the president will reportedly present a tax reform plan that's expected to call for lowering the corporate tax rate from 35 to 15%. And there's talk of a compromise to put GOP health care reform back on the agenda. So joining us by Skype, Congressman Tom Garrett, a Republican from Virginia. He sits on the House Homeland Security Committee and is a member of the Freedom Caucus. And Congressman, you've told us you have faith the wall will eventually be built and a Republican health care bill will pass. So start with the president's foreign policy. Are you concerned about a saber rattling in North Korea or airstrikes in Syria?
Yeah, so I've been very hesitant to continue the acceleration of American engagement in Syria. We outlined very early on sort of our policy that we shouldn't engage in regime change activities without being able to realistically articulate the improvement that will come about as a result of the regime change. Having said that, all indicators are that Assad used chemical weapons on his own population to include a disproportionate number of women and children. So I think that response was appropriate. As it relates to North Korea, I wish that we could do an entire segment. I wish that I could tell you everything I knew, but we are facing a paradigm unseen at least since the Cuban Missile Crisis and perhaps ever in human history. Kim has indicated a great willingness to engage not only in the further development of nuclear weapons, but in rhetoric intimating a first strike. If I lived in Seoul, if I lived in Tokyo, I wouldn't sleep well at night. But this is a very, very real threat that would exist no matter who was in the White House. It's an interesting paradigm to consider that any sort of first strike option would be wrought with political hell. But the alternative may be waiting to see Tokyo or Seoul or, God forbid, Los Angeles subject to a nuclear first strike. And again, I'm not overplaying this.
Well, no, I don't think you are. But so that prompts the question, given that, shouldn't the rhetoric be ratcheted down? I mean, do you want to see another American president draw a line in the sand that then someone dares them to cross?
Well, I'll tell you this. If I thought that we could act militarily and remove the North Korean nuclear threat without the loss of millions of lives, I would support it today. Again, this keeps me up at night more so than just about anything we've discussed. And I'm not blaming prior administration, although I have on several other issues. This has been lingering for years. President Trump has inherited a really, really, really tough situation. Again, an American military first strike sounds horrible until you contemplate that as opposed to the complete obliteration of a massive modern city of innocent people. And that's not beyond the realm of possibility right now. That's how bad this is.
Do you think President Trump, who has said several times on the job in these first 100 days, gee, I didn't realize this was so hard when it came to health care. And gee, I didn't realize that China really might not be a manipulator. Do you think, given your concerns about North Korea, is he the man, the person for the job right now?
You know, those comments from President Trump are not disheartening to me, but heartening. The fact that he's willing to make those sort of human admissions that, yeah, there's a lot going on here. This is tougher than I thought tells me, A, there's some humility there, which, you know, is refreshing.
What about his thin skin?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I see a lot different guy in small groups than I do in front of the camera. I candidly would do a lot of things differently as it relates to, you know, back and forth with Mark Cuban on Twitter or Rosie O'Donnell or what have you. I think that's wasted energy. But he's the president of the United States. I can count on, you know, maybe both hands how many professional pundits thought that was going to happen, you know, say November 5th of 2016. So he must be doing something right.
What grade do you give him?
Ooh, wow. B minus. There are a lot of things that could have been done better. If I were he, I would have come first with the tax reform package. I think if he were to start with corporate tax reform, if he says 15 and the Democrats say 28, and the Freedom Caucus says 20, and Paul Ryan says 25, we pick a number in the middle, and we can all say, hey, we got what we wanted. Take that victory lap, sort of encourage the American electorate that progress is being made. But I think generally we're headed in the right direction. He's certainly shown a lot more flexibility than a lot of folks, myself included, thought he'd show on things like that border wall funding. Messaging has been poor. But, yeah, I think by and large, we're pointing the direction he indicated he was going to point us, and I think good things are happening. I think the economic numbers are bearing that out, and I think we'll see economic growth, and I think it's going to be successful for 4 years.
Okay, thank you. Congressman Tom Garrett, a Republican from Virginia.
Well, we've already heard about President Trump's difficulty getting funding to build a wall on the border between the U.S. and Mexico. But as Michel Morisco from the Fronteras Desk at Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports, the U.S. Border Patrol has already started building a wall, not a concrete one, but a digital one.
In a dim, low-ceilinged room, federal agents and private contractors are testing the feed coming off cameras erected along the southeastern Arizona border. It's a subdued project when you consider the magnitude of the goal, eyes and ears, watching every movement along the U.S.-Mexico border, 24 hours, 7 days a week.
This has definitely been a force multiplier for us in being able to monitor multiple locations from one central location.
Border Patrol Supervisor Jonathan Romero oversees the camera operators. For him, this tower deployment eliminates a staffing issue.
And here, you can have one operator monitoring multiple sites at the same time. So it frees up additional manpower for us to deploy to the field while these agents are monitoring these sites in here.
The 80-foot-high towers have laser range finders, lights visible only with night vision goggles. Some are outfitted with ground sensor readers and can pick up the tiny shock of people walking. It's called the Arizona Border Surveillance Technology Plan, and it's a network of these towers, cameras mounted on pickup trucks, and backpack surveillance systems that can be hiked into the desert and dug into the ground. Agent Vicente Paco drives up the steep, rocky trail leading to one of the towers, looming over the border on a green hill. He says the system takes much of the guesswork out of patrolling the border.
Now, with some of this technology, we have an idea of what caused that activation. And if it's something where a single agent might be, for example, if it's a group of smugglers that are armed, you know, we might ask resources from our BORTAC or Special Operations Detachment.
The idea for the towers came out of an abandoned federal border project from 2007 that cost $1 billion but went nowhere. And it comes just as the White House presses on with plans for a massive cement wall. Here's the president last March at a rally in Tennessee.
We're going to build the wall. Some of the fake news said, I don't think Donald Trump wants to build the wall. Can you imagine if I said, we're not going to build the wall? Fake news. Fake news.
That was a few weeks before new Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly said there likely will not be a wall along the entire border, causing confusion among local governments and border residents about where the wall will go. Here in Arizona, all except about 50 miles of most of the state's 372-mile border with Mexico has some sort of either fencing to stop people or vehicle barrier. In the meantime, the Border Patrol is pushing to expand its towers project. Just days before Trump's inauguration, the agency asked developers to come up with ideas to expand the surveillance towers along the Mexican border and the Canadian around Detroit and Buffalo. The agency also called on developers to produce drones with facial recognition.
3, 8, 7, 9.
But the new technology will not replace agents. The Border Patrol has 21,000 agents and is still hiring. Vicente Paco says arrests still have to be made by a border agent.
Our agents are trained to utilize the tools they're giving, just like the stuff that I carry on my belt, you know, and we're trying to use it to our advantage.
Stop, Vern.
On a dirt road on the outskirts of Douglas, Arizona, retired school teacher Judy Herbert calls her dogs into the house. Her home sits down the hill from one of the new towers. 12 blocks away is a flowering field with a 15-foot wall of posts inches apart separating the state from Mexico. She says the towers are better than the alternative.
You have miles and miles and miles, if you haven't seen that already, of open area. How are they going to fence all that in a reasonable manner? I just don't see it happening.
She says she's not bothered by the tower that stands just over her home.
I really don't. It is on my property. I'm sure they see me come out in my in my robe. I have no idea. I have a hot tub.
Meanwhile, the fight over the concrete border wall continues. This month, environmentalists in Tucson filed the first lawsuit in the U.S. to stop it. Construction of a new concrete wall is scheduled to start in San Diego, and so far, Homeland Security hasn't said whether it's going to add hundreds of miles of concrete wall or make up for gaps in the line with this virtual one. For Here and Now, I'm Michel Marisco.
What happens when you put a world-renowned cellist, a MacArthur Fellow bassist, and another MacArthur winner and mandolin player together? Well, if they're Yo-Yo Ma, Edgar Meyer, and Chris Thiele, you get beautiful music. This is the Trio Sonata No. 6 in G Major from their new album, Bach Trios. Here and now, listeners, we are in for a treat. Yo-Yo Ma, Chris Thiele, and Edgar Meyer have come to our studios for a performance and a little conversation. Yo-Yo Ma, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be in one room with two geniuses.
And those other two geniuses are Edgar Meyer. Welcome to you.
Pleasure to be here.
And Chris Thiele, it's great to have you as well.
It's great to be here, Magna. It could have been you that was one of the two.
I think it's safe to assume that I would not include myself amongst the list.
Well, that's what makes you a genius.
Genius I'm referring, behavior, of I think. Course, to their MacArthur Genius
Oh,
Awards.
My goodness. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why, I just like to kind of bask in reflected glory. And I can hear it every time I hear them play. The quality and content of what they do is so gorgeous.
Well, and hearing the three of you come together is magnificent as well. But, I mean, okay, since we're on this thread of genius, let's talk about Bach a little.
Yes, there we go.
Now you're talking.
In the liner notes for your album, Timo Andres writes that put any random combination of musicians in a room together, and no matter what their instruments, histories, or personalities, it's more than likely they'll find common ground playing Bach. Why is that?
I think because some people write specifically for an instrument, but I think his concept of music, since he was an organist, and an organ actually represents so many instruments, I think his language is more architectural than indoor painterly kind of style. So you mix mandolin, cello, and bass, I think a combination that's never really occurred before. Remarkably, it sounds fabulous.
It is surprising. I mean, even in our world of more bluegrass-related things, it's one of the first places people go. Everybody seems to be attracted to it.
Just about any serious musician I've ever had a conversation with, arguments about who the greatest musician ever was start really boring because it's just Bach. You're all set to disagree with someone and no one says anything else.
Yeah.
But then, you get to number two and then the debate starts.
Yo-Yo, you just said a moment ago that this unexpected combination of cello, bass, and mandolin, and yet the three of you make it work so spectacularly. I mean, how do you make it work?
It is so fantastic to make music with people who have incredibly strong identities, but the content of what they do transcends ego placement. I feel the flexibility of their minds.
At this point, there's actually not that much thought. It's just your speaking voice. It's just like we're three people who like to talk to each other regardless of like maybe having sort of a perfectly, low sonorous voice and, someone with like a silvery voice. It has to do with what we're going to say. For the three of us, your speaking voice sounds like a cello. Edgar sounds like a bass. Mine sounds like a mandolin. That's just what we have to work with, and we like speaking with one another.
Well, speaking of talking to each other, you've all got your instruments here, and I would love it if you could play something from the new album. Again, it's called Bach Trios.
Ready for us? Here we go. Thank you.
that was so, so beautiful. I was also intrigued by watching how you were actually engaging with each other, because you were talking about hearing each other's voices.
That piece is particularly good in that way, because that piece really is three voices, three totally separate voices, each with something to say, but that, you know, combine for a harmonious whole.
You know, a melody like that, an ostensibly simple melody that can contain so much is, you know, this is one of the things that I've learned so much about. You know, having grown up playing mandolin, which is, you know, you tend to fill up the space because, you know, your instrument doesn't really fill it up naturally. So you just kind of play more and more and more notes. Interacting with these two gentlemen has given me a newfound appreciation for space and for the beauty contained in a simple, you know, you, I think about Yo-Yo's first entrance. Da, 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 da. And, I mean, every time it happens, we've played this piece a lot of times now. Every time it happens, I mean, I get chills.
It's so funny because this time I was so locked in to what you were doing, Chris, and I was just mesmerized by the sheer delicacy of phrasing, how intimate it was. You and know, so in that sense, it's a real privilege to be part of that.
I was feeling quite emotional listening to you guys play, to be perfectly honest, because you used the word delicacy and tenderness. I felt a tenderness. And to be quite honest, I feel like the world could use more tender silences or tender spaces.
Very well put.
One thing I was just thinking about, one of the purposes of learning how to play an instrument really well is so that you can go beyond the instrument. Sure, you're playing the bass, you're playing the mandolin, you play the cello, but you actually want to transcend that instrument so that you don't hear instrument, but rather you're hearing music. Here we are supposedly good at doing those instruments, but we're actually also then playing music that tries to transcend itself. And that's some of the feelings we get from playing some of those pieces, especially like, which is the one that I love so much.
Ich ruf zu dir.
Yeah.
Right?
You're in a space that is so wondrous and so amazing. This man was able to create the code that brings us all together into that space of wonder. I'm just devastated every time I hear it.
Yo-Yo Ma, Edgar Meyer, and Chris Thiele. The new album is Bach Trios. Thank you so very much for coming in, for playing, for transporting us. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with all of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
The Trump administration is moving to impose its first tariff. It would target Canadian lumber shipped to the United States, the kind used to build single-family homes, according to Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. And the Canadian government is now calling on the U.S. to, quote, rescind this unfair and unwarranted trade action. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us now. Hi there, Jason.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, the president, of course, did threaten tariffs during the presidential election, during the campaign, especially tariffs on China and Mexico, he repeatedly pointed out. But this one is on Canadian lumber. That would be around 20%. So how did we get here?
How did we get here? Well, this really is retaliatory action against Canada over a decades-old trade dispute. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross says this dispute centers on Canadian provinces that have been allegedly allowing loggers to cut trees down at improperly subsidized costs and sell them at lower prices. Now, the Canadian government said late Monday that it strongly disagrees with the Commerce Department's decision, and it argues that their reasoning was based on information that was baseless and unfounded and allegations that came from the U.S. lumber industry. But this really matters to them because this is, you know, represents, you know, $5 billion in trade. Lumber represents $5 billion in trade with the U.S.
Right. And I mean, to point to the U.S. lumber industry, you mentioned that they did file a complaint last fall to the Commerce Department alleging that Canada was unfairly dumping wood or lumber in the United States. So as to Canada's possible, you know, reactions, they're calling it baseless and unfounded, as you mentioned, but what actions could we expect from them?
Well, the foreign minister and resources minister of Canada's Liberal government says it plans to defend the country's lumber interests, and that includes possible litigation. It's also going to be pressing the Trump administration to rescind what it calls unfair and unwarranted trade actions. My colleagues Peter Nicholas and Paul Vieira report that in the lead up to this decision on lumber duties, U.S. Canada and Trade Watcher said the Trump administration's move on timber could actually serve as an opening gambit in laying out what Canada, what he wants, what, you know, the Trump wants with his negotiations with Canada over the North America Free Trade Agreement negotiations, which really haven't begun in earnest yet.
Ah, I see. Okay. So a wink to a war over NAFTA. Gotcha. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, but this is a preliminary announcement and it would need approval from the International Trade Commission, right?
Yes, right. But even a preliminary decision has immediate real-world consequences. It discourages importers from buying lumber from Canada. And, you know, Wilbur Ross says the Trump administration tried to negotiate a settlement, but was just simply unable to do so.
Okay. Now, in the beginning of our conversation here, we mentioned that Secretary Ross had said that this is the kind of lumber used to build single-family homes. If the tariff is passed, we just got a couple seconds here, would it make it more expensive to build homes in America?
The short answer is yes. I mean, lumber costs are the highest they've been in a decade, and U.S. home builders are among the biggest customers for Canadian lumber. Based on analysis from last year, a builder spends about $15,000 for softwood lumber in a single-family home, and that represents about 7% of the total construction cost of a home. So lumber costs could go up by around $3,000 for a typical home.
Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much.
You bet, Meghna.
When he was in his early 20s, Grant Sabatier was a college grad living with his parents without enough money to buy a burrito. By 30, he'd saved $1 million. He's now 32, the vice president of a company that started as a sidebar, and he writes the blog Millennial Money. Its mantra, save. Grant joins us from Houston, Texas. Bring us back to that moment when you realized, I have nothing. I live with my parents.
It was August 2010. I woke up and I wanted to go grab a burrito. I knew that my money was low, didn't quite realize how little money I had. I logged into my phone, checked the balance, and I had $2.26 left in my bank account, which was not even enough to get a side of guacamole, let alone that burrito. So pretty much rock bottom for me at my life then, and really just didn't want to feel that way ever again, and started very aggressively on my own saving and investing journey.
Well, we'll talk about how you saved and how you advise others do as well. But, you know, you're 20s. You're supposed to not have any money, you know, starving post-students. And it sounds like kind of a stressful thing to do in your 20s.
Yeah, it actually ended up being a pretty stressful thing to do. But one of the things I realized is, you know, I'd learned a little bit at that time about compounding interest. And so one of the biggest assets that I realized I had was just time. The value of saving when you're young is significantly more valuable than saving really at any time of your life. And so, you know, I started to make that mindset shift where, you know, I wanted to make as much money as possible, really so I could invest it and use compound interest, you know, to my advantage.
Well, and I know there's half the listening audience is probably going, what interest? Compound interest.
Ben Franklin called it the eighth wonder of the world. It's just the simple idea that over time, you know, when your money, say you invest in the stock market or you invest even in a savings account and your money makes interest. So say you invest a dollar and you get 10% interest, then you have $1.10. And then that next year, when you're getting interest again, you're making interest on your dollar and 10 cents, not just your dollar. So over a long period of time, that interest then compounds and the interest grows pretty significantly. So, mm-hmm. you know, Ben Franklin, you know, he invested a couple thousand dollars back in the late 1700s. And just that money that he invested then, that compounding over that period is worth hundreds of millions of dollars today.
Well, there you are. Even Ben Franklin makes an appearance in your story here. So you decide it's not just about making money, but it's about investing and saving money. And you get a good job. You've got a $50,000 a year marketing agency job when this story starts, but decided to work extra. Find a side hustle is your first tip. What do you mean by that?
In my quest to really invest as much money as possible, I did the simple math. And, you know, if you're making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year and you're saving, you know, 5 to 10% of your income, it's pretty hard to save enough and invest enough money to even retire in the next 30, 35 years. So one of the biggest things is when you look at the most successful people or the most successful and wealthiest people in the world, they really have two things in common. A lot of them are entrepreneurs and a lot of them have multiple income streams. And so even me with my $50,000 a year job, I knew that I needed to diversify my income streams and then invest as much money as the, you know, as I could from those extra income streams.
Yeah. So you do things like sell concert tickets. You launched a consulting company. You were building websites for businesses. I can see people saying, oh, on the side, I could drive an Uber car. But people are finding that some of those gigs in the gig economy, it's hard to save. They're low paying and they don't have benefits like company provided insurance.
To your point, the Uber example, it's tough to get ahead as an Uber driver, especially if you're using it as your primary source of income. But my friends who are Uber drivers, a lot of them now, they're doing it just to invest. So the future value of that dollar that they're making today on Uber is going to be worth $4 or $5 into the future. Mm. I tend to prefer and recommend side hustles that you're using to build skills. If you invest in your skills, if you learn to code, even if you, you know, say you walk dogs in your neighborhood and you build that skill and you build a client base and then you turn it into a small business, and then all of a sudden you've got, you know, multiple income streams and a business as opposed to just a simple side hustle.
Okay. So then you have the idea of how much to save, and you did the math again, and you figured out that you could meet your goal of $1 million by 30 if you saved at least $50 a day and earned on that saved money about 5% a year. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's it. The $50 a day early retirement strategy.
And I can hear someone saying, like, there's no way I have an extra $50 a day. But you started at $5 a day.
Yeah, starting at $5 a day really adds up. So if you save $5 a day and just invest it in a simple Vanguard total stock market index fund, and you get between 5 and 7% annually on that, you know, $5 a day that you're depositing, you'll have about $177,000 in 30 years.
Yeah.
And that's just $5 a day. And what I figured out is, for me personally, I determined that I needed $1,250,000 to retire, which is essentially 25 times my expected annual expenses of $50,000 per year. And I figured that in order to get there, I needed to save $50 a day for the next 30 years. And so when I shifted my mindset and started thinking about it on a day-to-day basis, then every dollar that I could save over that $50, I was going to be able to retire earlier.
Well, when you say you shifted your mindset,
Sure.
Sounds like this is all you were thinking about. First of all, by the way, you also cut your spending. So you went from saving 50% of your paycheck to 25%, eventually more than 40%. You were living in a really nice apartment, I understand, about $1,500 in Chicago, cut that to $800. It sounds like you were getting a little obsessed with this.
I think you're right. I think I did get a little obsessed with it, but I knew that's kind of what it would take to accelerate my financial independence. I knew that the stock market was set for a recovery. So every dollar that I invested and sacrificed back then in 2010, 2011 is worth $3.25 today.
Now, I was going to ask you, how much do you think you actually put away to get to the million?
I ended up putting away about $350,000 to $400,000.
Wow.
And now I have really kind of the rest of my life to, you know, pursue the projects that I'm interested in.
Unless you fall victim to the dreaded lifestyle inflation.
Oh, lifestyle inflation.
We read about this in the Washington Post that, you know, you can – you're scrimping and you're getting the change out of the couch pillows. You're investing. Suddenly, there it is. You've got that $1 million. You're 30 years old. It's amazing how quickly the mind can flip and suddenly you're spending.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm human like anyone else. That's what people – it's like, yeah, sure, I saved $1 million by the time I was 30, but I make a lot of mistakes and I share a lot of the mistakes that I make very openly on the blog. And one of the biggest ones is just lifestyle inflation. The calculation is built around me saving – not saving, but being able to spend about $50,000 per year for the rest of my life. And so if I go considerably over that, I'm going to have to make more money and invest it. The thing is, once I reach financial independence, you know, I didn't stop working. I'm still making quite a bit of money. And so I have some more flexibility there. But I quickly realized last year that I was spending a lot more money than I'd ever spent and that, you know, I really had to rein it in and get it under control.
Yeah, you were spending maybe, thousands on a Napa Valley weekend or $75 for takeout. And that's a cautionary tale. That million can go fast.
It can totally go fast. And this is one of the things I hear from a lot of lawyers and doctors that read my blog that haven't saved anything and they wonder where it all went. So, you know, it's always about finding that balance between spending and saving and just really being honest, you know, with yourself about, is what I'm spending money on, is it making me happy? The biggest takeaway is, you know, a lot of people think money is a lot more complicated than it actually is. And if you just start paying yourself first and view saving as an opportunity as opposed to a sacrifice, and you just keep putting it away, you know, you're going to wake up in 5, 10, or 15 years with a lot more money than you realized you would ever be able to have. It's really just about breaking it down, taking it a day at a time. It's really, really hard to think, how am I going to save $1 million or $2 million? But if you break it down each day and try to save as much as you can, it really adds up pretty quickly.
That's Grant Sabatier. He writes the Millennial Money blog, and he's also now Vice President of Digital Strategy for Eduvantis Digital. Grant, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it, Robin.
The World Health Organization is beginning a new initiative to test the world's first malaria vaccine on 750,000 toddlers in the African countries of Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi next year. Even with existing malaria treatments and preventative measures such as mosquito nets, these countries still experience high malaria mortalities, especially in children. And this vaccine could change that. Joining us now via Skype from Geneva is David Kaslow of the nonprofit PATH, where he's director of their Center for Vaccine Innovation and Access. PATH helped fund and develop this vaccine. David, welcome.
Thank you.
So first of all, tell us, is there a lot of excitement around this vaccine test for malaria?
Yeah, so this is a really important milestone for development of malaria vaccines at large. It's the first time that a malaria vaccine will go into pilot implementation.
The first time, okay, in the long history of humanity trying to fight this disease. But do we already have a sense as to how effective or not effective this vaccine might be?
We do. And the strongest evidence of how this vaccine works comes from a very large, well-conducted clinical trial in Africa by African scientists that showed that this vaccine, RTSS, reduced the number of malaria cases by half in young children over the first year after vaccination, and that protection was actually prolonged by a fourth dose, which ultimately prevented 4 in 10 malaria cases over a four-year follow-up.
Now, there may be people who react to those numbers and say, ooh, long-term prevention, 4 out of 10, maybe it's not that effective. So why is there so much excitement around this vaccine?
Well, despite really good progress in controlling malaria over the last 15 years, malaria still remains one of the world's deadliest diseases. It still kills nearly 500,000 persons every year, mostly in Africa, mostly in children. What I encourage Here and Now listeners to think about is this. Malaria kills a classroom full of 25 children every 30 minutes, day in, day out. And the real tragedy is that these deaths of malaria are completely preventable and treatable and really should be considered unacceptable. We need new tools to fight this disease, and this is potentially one of them, imperfect as it may be.
Yeah. So I see your point that if this vaccine does prove effective, you know, you could say there's a 250,000 lives potentially that could be saved every year. But you mentioned a little bit earlier that there are 4 rounds of shots for the complete implementation of the vaccine. Are there challenges, sort of medical infrastructure challenges in any of these countries that could prevent parents from getting their children to doctors, to clinics for all 4 shots?
Potentially, yes. And that's one of kind of 3 things that this pilot implementation, which we hope to implement in 3 countries beginning in 2018, is meant to answer. One of those is how feasible is it to administer all 4 doses of this vaccine in a real life setting of a routine health service delivery in low resource settings? I mean, the other things we want to know is what impact does it have on overall childhood survival? And finally, what, if any, reactions are there associated with receiving this vaccine? So what adverse events are associated with it? So those are the 3 major things we hope to accomplish in this pilot implementation program.
And what about cost?
Well, at this point, the cost has not been set, although the manufacturer of this vaccine, GlaxoSmithKline, has stated that they will price it at the cost of manufacturing plus a small percentage that they'll reinvest in developing country diseases.
You mentioned earlier that there's been this long battle against malaria. And I understand that this vaccine in particular, RTSS, took some 30 years to develop. And that development process had to rely on funding from your organization and for others. I mean, why does it take so long to develop a vaccine against this disease?
So this is a really pesky parasite. It's evolved with humans for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. It's figured out how to evade protective immune responses, and it's a challenge. And there are 4 different species that we need to address vaccines against. This is just one. It's the most deadly form of it, and it was really, you know, trial and error, trying a variety of different approaches before we landed on one where we took the major coat protein from the parasite, mixed it in with the hepatitis B vaccine, and put it with a powerful immune system stimulator to really drive the right type of immune response to block the parasite as it tries to get to the liver. So it's a complicated life cycle and takes a pretty powerful immune response to block it.
Well, that's David Kaslow. He is with PATH, the International Health Organization, where he's the director of their Center for Vaccine Innovation and Access. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young, and this is Here and Now.